Good morning. Welcome to the House Judiciary Committee for Thursday, February 23rd. Our first order of business, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Szymanski.
Present.
Representative Mazerall.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah.
Representative Allen.
Here.
Representative Anderson.
Here.
Representative Champion.
Here.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Grunhagen.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Kreisel. Representative Lane. Representative Lesch. Representative Liebling.
Here.
Representative Schumacher.
Present.
Representative Smith.
Here.
Representative Swazinski. Representative Vogel.
Present.
Representative Wardlow.
The quorum is present. Approval of the minutes from the previous meeting. As the committee looked over, Representative Grunhagen moves the minutes of the previous meeting. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. Minutes are approved. Okay. For those of you visiting today, our agenda first calls up House File 2246. Our author has been delayed. We will postpone that till later in this hearing, probably right near the end of the hearing. But we will also begin with House File 322, continuing testimony with Representative Scott. Before we begin testimony, I would like to ask for a show of hands with our guests here, testifiers. Those that would like to testify in support of this bill, would you raise your hand so we can get a bit of a count here? Okay. All right. Thank you for raising your hands. Those who would like to testify in opposition to this bill, would you raise your hands? All right. Thank you. Just to let those visiting today know that on Tuesday of this week, we took the initial testimony on this bill, and we would like to divide the time equally. So at this time, we will ask the Representative Scott and your testifiers to limit your time to check with my clerk here how much time we can allocate. Yeah, we'd allocate 2 minutes per testifier for those in support of the bill, to allow adequate time for those in opposition. So, Representative Scott, welcome to our committee, and begin with your continuing testimony.
All right. Thank you, Chair and members. We'll just dive right into testimony this morning. The first person we have to testify is Sue Rinkenberger.
Good morning and welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Sue Rinkenberger and I live in Shoreview, Minnesota. I'm a mother, a grandmother, and a great-grandmother. I have an adorable 15-month-old great-grandson. My grandson is 19 and the mother is also very young. When they first found out about the pregnancy, they were full of plans for the future, but now, for now, she and the baby were going to live with my grandson, who was still living at home with his mom and stepdad. My grandson was there during the entire pregnancy. He took her to the majority of doctor's appointments, and when the baby was born, he was the only one there because that was their wish, for the birth to be between the two of them. It was a special time for them together. The baby made a huge impact on my grandson. He never had his biological father in his life, and when he became a father, he knew he wanted a different experience for his boy. He went from a rebellious teen to a responsible young man. He started full-time in college, got a full-time job, and was focused on being the best dad he could possibly be. As he had been involved in his son's life, as you would want any dad to be. He provided his son and his son's mother with food, clothing, shelter, transportation. He purchased diapers, medicine, formula, as well as had gotten the baby's mother set up with a computer and bought her books so she could study for her GED. He also provided health insurance for the baby. He did all this voluntarily, willfully, on his own for 2 years before paternity had even been established. He provided His family provided much of the furniture and strollers and hay chair for the baby and much more, just like tradition for centuries before, family was helping family. As the months went by, reality set in, and their plans for the future fell apart, and the relationship was no longer there. But the one thing that they did agree on was joint custody for the baby. They recently went to a court to establish paternity. They had agreed to petition the court for joint legal and joint physical custody, and she told him she changed her mind at the last minute, that she was going to ask for sole custody and sole physical and legal custody. They went to court. He still asked for joint custody, as was the plan. Since they didn't agree, they would have to go to trial. She would have to get an attorney, which would be paid for by the taxpayers. He would have to pay for his own. The judge said he couldn't grant parenting time for him until the mother had a chance to consult with her attorney. My grandson left the courtroom that day with no rights to see his son. So now when he sees the baby, when she allows it, and she can use the baby like a pawn, and he has nothing to say about it. Her change of plans on custody was very confusing to me. So since I had a good relationship with her, I called her and asked her why she had changed her mind. And she told me that the county had told her she needed to file for joint custody. And when I asked her why, she said she didn't really know, except she thought it had something to do with qualifying for more public assistance programs.
Excuse me, Ms. Rinkenberger. Representative Smith, did you have a question?
I'll wait till the testifier is done.
All right. Ms. Rinkenberger, we've exceeded the time limit.
Okay.
If you would like to just give us a one or two sentence in summary yet, we'll continue.
This bill is for kids, and the two people in the best position to love these kids are their mother and the father. So please give these kids a better chance for a family and pass House File 322 for the presumption of joint physical custody and equal shared parenting for the sake of the kids. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. So, yes, we will attempt to reserve all questions till the end if the committee would give us that latitude. And I would also like to remind the committee that this bill will be heard today, but will continue to be laid over. We were here to receive testimony on this bill this morning. So, Representative Scott, your next testifier.
Thank you. I'm not sure if he's here or not. Jonathan Uecker? Dr. Uecker this morning. So we'll go on to the next one. Drew Campbell. Okay. Patrick Frank. Am I in the wrong place? I'm sorry. No. Benedictus Mbuna.
Good morning and welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the committee members. My name is Benedictus Mbuna from Inver Grove Heights, Minnesota. Let me start by saying that I never believed in raising my son, Custis, that the day would come in my lifetime where he would be taken from me by a family court order. After his mother died, the same family court judge that granted me sole custody of my son to me took away my life's purpose, my child. Michelle McDonald and I have been engaged in the defense of innocent families through the Family Innocence Project. Parents need a law recognizing their legal and physical custody rights to ensure that no other parent goes through the same pain and anguish I went through. After acquiring a debt of over $50,000, the judge reversed the wrongful custody order, dismissed the case, and removed himself for his error. But the damage to my child and our family is not irreversible and not repairable. I never thought, coming to the United States, I never thought family injustice could happen in America. Where I understood, fit parents have the freedom and liberty to raise their children without government interference. Children belong with both parents, and parenting responsibilities belong to both parents, even if they separate. The law should have no power to say otherwise. This joint fiscal presumption and shared parenting law is not politics. This is family justice. God bless Family Innocence Project, and please say yes to a bill which will prevent injustices in the family court by providing equality for all parents. Say yes to Bill HF 322. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ombunda.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Scott.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Tom Shimota.
Good morning, sir. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning.
Please have a seat and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Tom Shimota. I live in Rosemount, Minnesota. I'm a business owner and parent of two children and share joint legal and physical custody with their mother, who lives in Forest Lake. Because I had no money for an attorney, I defended myself in a custody battle. There were more than 50 court motions, and we ended up with joint physical custody. We were both of modest means. The mother of my children spent over $125,000 with an attorney. Pope John Paul II said, "The great danger for family life in the midst of any society whose idols are pleasure, comfort, and independence lies in the fact that people close their hearts and become selfish." Looking back, we both loved and wanted our children with us all of the time. Even though we were breaking up, we did not want to share, and the law did not require us to. The law, in fact, says when we can't agree, one parent is a loser with 25% of the time, and the other is a winner parent with 75% of the time. Neither of us were unfit parents. Our children were housed, fed, clothed, well-educated, but most of all, loved by both of us. The attorneys allowed us and encouraged us as zealous advocates to argue and litigate in court all of our personal family matters and bring up each other's faults in motion after motion. The fight ended when we both came to an agreement for joint physical custody with the mediator on our way to appeals court. If the law would have stated that both of us had a presumption to joint physical custody and equaled shared parenting, we would have accepted this, and there would have been no custody battle. While we couldn't see that at the time, the law would have dictated that what was and is today the best thing for our children. Please vote yes for HF 322. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shimota. Representative Scott.
Sarah Olson Andrews.
Good morning. Welcome to our committee, and please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Hi, my name is Sarah Andrews. I live in Bloomington, Minnesota. Formerly Sarah Olson, I was the granddaughter and the subject of the Minnesota Supreme Court case Olson v. Olson. I was 10 years old then, and I'm 26 years old now. Judicial broad discretion and vague laws in family court gave my mother a reason and an open door to fight as long as she could and damage my family and myself. Because my family was fighting a legal battle over me, my college fund was spent, my inheritance gone. My grandmother, whom I loved, has died, and my mother is not in my life. Looking back on the court battle I was raised in, it saddens me deeply. In the process, I remember everyone talking about the best interest of the child. If you read the case, it looks like the court considered my best interest as paramount. Don't let the paperwork fool you. None of it was in my best interest. It seemed then, and it seems now, like total lip service. I just wanted all my family, every parent and grandparent I could get, more people to love me, not less. As an adult child of divorce, looking back, it feels like a complete charade. The court pretending they are capable of making this determination when they are not. There is no way a court is capable of really understanding what goes on in the family, no matter how many lawyers or judges or experts they try and throw at a case. My parents divorced when I was 3. If a child is fortunate enough to have two parents that love them, it should be the God-given right of that child to know both parents and spend equal time with each parent willing to take that responsibility. The love a parent has for a child does not change due to divorce or anything else. So why then is it even plausible a parent should need to fight to continue the parent-child relationship? I can see now that I'm grown, the entire case fought over me when I was a child was all based solely on fear and pride. Family who all loved me, each of them fighting over me, for fear that they would lose me, when none of them should have had to lose me at all. The fear of not getting something you want or losing something you already have makes parents do crazy things. Wouldn't we all act crazy if there was a fear of you could lose your child? With a family court system so quick to take away a parent's rights for whatever reason they want under the guise of the best interest of the child and judicial discretion, of course parents will react out of things like fear, spite, and pride. The best thing we can do for parents is not put them in the position. The best way to empower two fit parents to work together and truly act in their best interest is to treat both parents as equally important. It is insane to think that after going through a divorce, the child or children involved could be completely separated from a parent. That should not even be an option. I am now a wife and a mother of 3, and it baffles me to see all the time and energy it takes and years of discussing this issue to decide something that seems to be common sense. You should not have to fight to see your own children. Please vote yes on House File 322 for a presumption of joint physical custody and equal shared parenting time for fit parents. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Scott? Would you call up
Michael McCaulkey.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Michael Mulcahy, and I reside in St. Paul, Minnesota, and am an adult of a child divorce. Following the same reasoning as Minnesota Supreme Court Justice Sandy Keith, I too believe, quote, that we ought to be able to resolve disputes in a better manner than the total adversary system. I think the whole concept of shared parenting makes a lot of sense and ought to be given consideration. I grew up for the first 25 years of my life with my parents being married. I had the great fortune of growing up in a household where both parents cared considerably for myself and my younger siblings. I was not so naive to see from a young age the sacrifices my parents made in exchange for the best interest of us children. Growing up with both parents, I also had the opportunity to see two incredibly smart, reasonable people who started with nothing become extremely successful with businesses they started. More than simply learning the value of the almighty dollar, my parents stressed the duty we had as citizens of a community to earn that dollar through honesty, goodwill, and hard work. My parents were the perfect example of what I strive to be someday. At the age of 25, my mother left my father. It seemed abrupt to my father, but both myself and my siblings knew they were not happy for years. From the very moment my father was aware of my mother's intentions, I saw these two smart, reasonable, and honest people become absolute monsters. They became irrational, perverse, tenacious, and downright dishonest. My full-time job became mediating disputes over the most arbitrary of issues, like who gets the laundry basket. I became extremely frustrated with their juvenile and unruly behavior until I came home to my father's and opened the fridge one night only to find an overripe avocado and some peanuts. My family had never had expensive cars or flashy jewelry, but we always had a full fridge. I was not sure if my father had even eaten in days. It was then that I realized for the first time in 55 years he'd been on the planet, this is the hardest time ever in both him and my mother's life. I used to come home to find the bathroom fan on my mother's house with her crying so she would not hear me. These smart, reasonable, honest people were so emotionally devastated that they were reduced to fight for parenting time over such things as the laundry basket. I was grateful neither of my siblings, both of whom did not live near our home, did not have to witness this degeneration. I was even more grateful, however, that all of us were growing up.
Mr. Mulcahy?
Yes, sir. Okay.
Can we wrap it up in a
sentence
or two?
Yes, sir. I believe my story is not unfamiliar. Working with attorney Michelle McDonald and seeing the family she so worked hard with the Family Innocence Project has confirmed my belief. The presumption of equal shared parenting bill would allow the state to do what even the best parents may not be able to do while experiencing their own emotional turmoil, and that is put the best interest of the child first. Please vote yes for House File 322. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Scott?
Joe Field.
Good morning, sir. Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Joe Field. I'm an attorney with 18 years of family law experience. I'm here today to state that I strongly favor the bill that's before you. My opinion stems from being in the trenches of family law, or what I refer to as anti-family law, because what it has done to families. Unless you are a close family member, have been involved with it, one cannot conceive the nightmare that the family justice system is for many parents. In large part, the nightmare is due to conflict, and conflict produced by nasty custody fights. It is a conflict that affects each parent and the children. Now, why? It is also, it's ugly, brutal, and most of the time, quite unnecessary. Why would I say that? Because parents basically desire equal shared parenting to begin with. They don't want to hurt their children, and both parents want to be able to see their children as much as possible after a divorce or custody award. Now, don't get me wrong, the divorce process is usually painful anyway. It has a pain scale of maybe 3 or 4 out of 10 when there's no kids involved. But throw kids in the mix with custody and parenting time issues, and now that pain threshold doubles. Remember this if you remember nothing else. Custody battles are the most divisive, mean-spirited, psychologically crushing battles a person will engage in their lifetime. And you have it within your power to change this dynamic. For children, custody battles are devastating. I have heard of sobbing 7-year-olds pleading and begging their parents during the custody process to stop the fighting. But the fights go on until the last child turns 18, all the while the winning parents calling the losing parent a loser, and the losing parent fights back, and on it goes. A change in the preference to joint physical custody will eliminate this entrenchment and will be the catalyst for compromise and goodwill. Have you ever thought about how traumatic it is for kids to go from seeing both parents virtually 100% of the time to seeing only one 20% of the time? Fathers are supposed to make a difference in their kids' lives, right? Reducing their time to 50% is bad enough, but reducing it to 20 to 25% essentially forces the children into instability. For everyone should agree by now that both parents bring something to the table when rearing children. In closing, I will say, pass this bill. You will reduce conflict. Parents like that. Children like that. But attorneys who rely on conflict to fill their coffers perhaps won't. And you can go back and tell your constituents that you felt sorry for the lawyers. Good luck with that one. Now, I am a lawyer, and I do make a living as a lawyer, but my concern is for the greater good. And much like an auto mechanic will tell you to get oil changes to prevent future damage to your vehicle, that's a preemptive measure, even though he loses business. This is a preemptive measure, even if lawyers will lose business. Pass this bill, please.
Thank you for your testimony.
Jerome Schoenecker.
I agree. Thank you, Representative Scott. While we're waiting, I would like to welcome the visitors in our gallery today, the FFA students who have with us today for FFA Day on the Hill. For the committee members, I would ask for your attention and welcome them to our committee. So. All right, sir, would you introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Jerome Schoenecker, and I'm a social worker and a master's degree from Boston University. I'm a co-founder of the Resource Center for Fathers and Families. Since the mid-90s, I've run support groups for fathers and taught parenting and step-parenting and relationship classes and workshops and done some private counseling. I'm speaking in favor of House File 322 because of the unequal status currently experienced in the family court system. Some unintended results occur which are very harmful to children and ultimately to the entire family. The unity of the family must as nearly as possible be maintained. When there is open conflict between the parents, the children think they have to choose. Because the permanency barrier has been broken, relationships are now tenuous, so the children, to survive, will choose the winner. They will choose the one that they spend disciplinary and daily functional time with, the one who most affects their lives. Why do they have to choose? Why can't they have both? In the absence of two parents who can love them on a daily basis, they need two separated parents who can at least help them reconcile the differences, differing parenting styles that teach them how to take for themselves what's true and valuable. The adversary nature of the court exacerbates the problem. It invokes the win-lose paradigm. In this paradigm, one is the winner and one's the loser. It presumes a good guy and a villain, one up and one down. The problem is that if the villain starts moving up, the other one starts moving down and invoking the adversarial response. They can't both be up. The paradigm requires that both parties believe it to make it happen. We try to help parents disbelieve that. We try to help them support the other parent, even when they're not getting the favorable results they'd like. To disbelieve it requires forgiving the other parent from the heart and taking responsibility for one's own actions in the situation. It's a very difficult thing to do, but is vitally necessary. When the parents are out of the court system, which enhances the adversarial nature of the relationship, the need to win is minimized because 24/7 is a lot of time. It becomes obvious to most parents that two parents work better than one when they can work together. The court system is a very large system. It has all kinds of adjuncts, such as guardians ad litem, custody evaluators, early neutral evaluators, etc. They largely support the winner in the win-lose paradigm. So while in the court system, great damage is done in the name of winning. The damage is emotional and very hard to reverse, especially in a long, drawn-out or very intensely adversarial process. The joint custody presumption levels the playing field and makes negotiation possible without loss of face. When one parent has veto power with no apparent loss to their position, it's destructive to both sides. The loser has lost respect in the eyes of the children, and the, quote, winner has to be fearful of losing their respect, too. The winner knows in some way that the victory is a hollow one, and they become fearful of losing the children's love.
Right. Mr. Schroenick, if you have more, we could wrap it up. Well,
okay, thank you. Much of the problem beginning in the 50s was still touted by Australian Jennifer Ann McIntosh. It was from John Bowlby's earliest speculation that infants had only one significant parent. That was the mother, and fathers were seen as peripheral. The research reviewed by Bowlby himself 20 years later indicated that the loss or attenuation of significant relationships in childhood can cause anxiety and profound sense of loss. He goes on to say that to be responsive to the infant's psychological needs, the parent's scheduling adopted for children younger than 2 and 3 must involve more transitions rather than less to ensure the continuity of both relationships and the child's security. And the ideal situation is one in which infants and toddlers have opportunities to interact with both parents every day or every other day in a variety of functional contexts, and that's what's missing.
Mr. Schoenecker,
feeding the baby, discipline, et cetera. I would like to ask you to support House File 322.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim Shadko.
Morning, sir. Welcome to our committee. Introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Jim Shadko. I'm a Minnesota State High School official. I'm a guardian ad litem in Hennepin County. I live in Hennepin County, and I am a non-custodial parent. I do really believe that divorcing parents see the importance of maintaining and supporting the existing child-parent relationships. It's in the best interest of the children. Regrettably, the process we currently have in family court as it relates to physical custody doesn't bring out the best in parents, particularly when they are reminded by the court that there is something worth fighting for, sole physical custody. We're motivating parents to model certain behaviors that their children would be embarrassed to witness. Why focus on the prize of sole physical custody when we ought to be empowering both parents to do what's in the best interest of their children, to co-parent through joint physical custody? Now my story. After departing family court, I had a difficult time reconnecting with my children. I could never get my children to come to my new home, just 12 blocks from their mother's home. Neither child spent one night with me, despite my many, many efforts. Neither child spent one holiday or a special occasion with me, such as Christmas, Thanksgiving, or birthdays. My only face time with my children was at school events, and most of that time was at a distance. In other words, on the sidelines. I left my wife and that led to our divorce. I paid a dear price for my infidelity. My children paid an even greater price. I want to encourage you to take the competition out of family court and let's replace it with cooperation and fair play. Please support HF 322.
Thank you, Mr. Shadko.
Mr. Chairman, may I please
Representative
ask
Smith.
One question of this witness?
Go ahead, Representative Smith.
You left court with your wife having custody and you having some form of parenting or visitation. Did you have a trial, sir, and the judge came up with that arrangement? Or did you enter into an agreement with your wife and do it that way and not go to trial?
I didn't.
Mr. Shadko.
I didn't go to trial.
So you agreed to that situation, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Did. That's all.
All right, Representative Scott.
Mr. Shadko. I just want to know if Jim Shad, our testifier here, would just answer a question, and that is why he chose to make an agreement outside of court.
Mr. Shadko.
I thought that I was going to have the complete cooperation from my wife. At the time, we were great parents. We weren't great spouses, but we were great parents. We both had our value systems were lined up really well, and I just didn't want to fight in family court over trying to gain sole physical custody because I knew what the result would be, and my attorney advised me that way, and I really don't regret that decision at all.
Thank you, Mr. Shadko. Representative Scott.
Drew Rhodes.
Morning. Morning, sir. My name is Andrew Rhodes.
Good morning. Welcome
to the
committee.
I'm a proud father. I have two beautiful children from my former wife. I'm a proud father of two stepchildren. I live in Woodbury, Minnesota, and I'd like to share my story with you. Yesterday in the news, we had the Lakeville father who just abandoned return from California. It appears he's negotiating joint custody with his estranged wife who lost custody in 2002. And I'd like to quote a few things that is very important. It says from the mother's attorney that Emily Cooper introduced the idea of joint custody as a way for Porter, mother, to gain parental rights again. And the only way for her to do that is for the child to be placed with the parents, both parents, and they have to start cooperating. Mother's attorney, Ms. Cooper, said this actually could end up being one of the best things for Sebastian, the 10-year-old son. So what we're saying is, in a high contentious divorce case, it's better to place the child with two unfit parents, a parent who abandoned him, than we are in many of these cases with two loving parents who just want to see their children. I find that extremely odd, and I'm perplexed that our current state of judicial system is encouraging this. Sir, on May 16, 2011, you read House File 1023, the Omnibus Judiciary Bill. Representative Joe Mahoney said, and I quote, "Something has to be done with the courts, and I don't know how we educate the judges to do a better job," close quote. Representative Tina Liebling, ma'am, you said, "I'm not saying no adjustments are needed," close quote. Representative Franson said, "I'm going to have to say that men are not second-class citizens here, and it's time we give men equal access to their children when it comes to divorce," close quote. Representative Gauthier said, quote, "We should never tie child support to visitation, and it gets crazy in the heat of battle. But I can also tell you that I believe there's a bias in the court system against men," close quote. That's from this legislative body. Those are from your peers, and we're admitting the biases in family courts. Let's move on to Popple versus Popple.
Mr. Rhodes,
our time
is up. So if you'd like to give a summation.
If I could just summarize the Popple, okay. And I'll close. Yes, sir. Popple versus Popple was a case where a domestic abuse appellant mother was committed domestic assault against the father in front of a police officer. She had admitted blood alcohol content of 0.116, and she pleaded guilty to domestic assault. But the judge opined, ultimately, child is blessed with two loving, competent parents, each of whom brings different strengths and emphasis to the child-parent relationship. They were both awarded joint physical custody when father, on a temporary court order, was given sole physical custody. This is our current state. I'd ask you to please support House File 322 and grant joint physical presumption of joint physical custody. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. Representative Scott.
That concludes our testifiers for the moment.
All right. All right. Okay. Do we have any questions from the committee for any of the testifiers that we've heard to this point this morning? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when I just want questions for Representative Scott, should I wait till all the testifying is
I think done? That would be appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. All right. Who would like to testify next on this bill? Okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
Would you have a seat at the table and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you. Mr. Chair and the committee, my name is Ann Lepinen. I'm a retired Ramsey County District Court family referee. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to address you this morning. I would like to share with you my perspective on the reality of what House File 322 will create based on my experience as a judicial officer and my 30 years of legal experience primarily in the area of family law. First of all, in family court, we're seeing parties and parents who are at their most emotional and traumatic time. It's not an easy situation for families, parents, or children. When parents are making decisions about how to move forward to best parent their children, the law currently now provides them with the option of sharing joint legal and joint physical custody with equal shared parenting time. The law provides them with the option of parenting via a parenting plan. Having these options allows parents to make choices as to how they will raise their children. These parents do not need, as a rule, a presumption to reach an agreement on what is best for their family. They are now doing it under the current law. But in those cases where parents are unable to reach agreements on physical custody, House File 322 will create a hornet's nest of both pre- and post-decree litigation. It will legislatively mandate a parent to overcome the highest burden of proof in our civil legal system by clear and convincing evidence if he or she believes that joint physical custody and equal parenting time is not in their child's best interest. The consequence will be increased litigation. That's plain and simple. And this consequence flies in the face of all of the efforts that the judiciary has made to reduce family court litigation over the past several years. On April 23, 2004, former Chief Justice Kathleen Blatt issued an order permitting judicial districts to develop family court pilot programs designed to expedite resolution of litigation, reduce acrimony, and reduce cost to parties by resolving disputes peacefully and reducing numbers of appeals and post-judgment hearings. This order was issued in part as a response to the court's recognition that traditional adversarial litigation is not in children's or families' best interests. The judiciary and state court administration have worked tirelessly since that time to develop early case management as an alternative to traditional litigation. These pilot projects are just now getting started on a statewide basis, but in the pilot counties, such as Hennepin and Ramsey County, they have been very successful and have been geared to putting parents in the driver's seats to work together and make choices on parenting arrangements that's best for the family. With case management, the judicial officer meets with the family, meets with the parties in dissolution, paternity, and custody proceedings within 3 weeks of the filing. The judicial officer sits down and discusses with the parties, and while the attorneys are present, the discussion is with the parties to talk about what options are out there to resolve their situation. They talk about mediation, the judges talk about early neutral evaluations, and the direction is to encourage the families, encourage the mother and the father to take control of their lives and their children's lives, and to avoid the court system litigation. Families come to the courts with a host of underlying issues such as related to custody and parenting time. Some of them directly impact their ability to co-parent, such as domestic violence, and others impact co-parenting indirectly, such as economic issues as to which parent can remain in the family home, whether both or one of the parents' employment or support makes equal custody unworkable. These issues cross all socioeconomic, racial, and cultural lines. If this bill is passed, in cases where parents cannot agree, even if they both agree that the parent that they should each spend time with the children, but they disagree on how much, it will mandate the court to ignore these issues and order joint physical and equal parenting time, and effectively remove, if not all, but most judicial discretion. We will be forced to issue a one-size-fits-all arrangement rather than a decision that looks at each individual family situation. It's important to talk about the impact of child support determinations on parenting time in this bill. Minnesota child support laws now consider both parents' incomes and the amount of time a child spends with each parent. Equal parenting time results in payment of less court-ordered child support. This puts money in the middle of the family's discussion about parenting time. Additionally, if a one-size-fits-all presumption doesn't work for a family and a joint custodial parent eventually is parenting substantially more, the financial burden will fall on that parent. House File 322 will contribute to an increase in motions to modify custody and an increase to modify child support. These motions will then be met with counter motions for contempt where one parent says, I have 50-50 custody, but I don't see my child 50% of the time. And then the litigation is back on the table. With an ever-growing population of self-represented litigants, it's not difficult to imagine the massive amounts of time and resources this will consume from child support magistrates, family court referees, judges, county attorneys, and court staff. I sit on the state Early Case Management, Early Neutral Steering Committee. This past month, the committee presented a best practices policy paper to state court administration, which will soon be presented to the state judicial council. Early case management and the proposed policies support the public policy set forth in House File 322 that our society, state, and statutes should support and not supplant parents' roles in their children's lives. For the multitude of reasons, House File 322 will undermine, if not halt, the judiciary's efforts to return control of families' futures to families. I urge you to defeat this legislation that mandates a presumption of joint physical custody with equal shared parenting time for these reasons. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Leppinen. We have a question for you, Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, it's not so much of the question as a cheap editorializing comment, but no.
Proceed, Representative Cornish.
It's just that I couldn't disagree with you more. You see it when they come into the court system, maybe, but in my 36-year career as a law enforcement officer, I've seen them at their worst when things turn really bad in the house or out in public. And I think this is a good bill. It's a great step in the right direction. We've been fumbling over it for years, and it needs to be passed. And it's just the judicial process we have right now, I don't think is fair. I think it's a train wreck, and it's all over the board depending on the judge, and we need some uniformity. And that's why I support the bill. And I think also, not only that, but I speak as a divorced man with three children that went through this. And the system really stinks the way it is right now, and I hope it changes. Thank you.
All right. All right. And do we have another question? Well, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when Representative Cornish makes a self-described cheap editorial statement, I think I need to make a contravailing statement, although I wouldn't call it cheap editorialism.
Representative Liebling, what's not?
She always does.
Representative Cornish.
Yeah, but Mr. Right. Chair, I just want to say, and for everyone in the room, you know, we all care deeply about families and about fairness in court. And we all, I think the testifier is letting us all know that we all care about reducing conflict. That is everybody's goal. The real question before us is whether this bill does that. That's the question, not whether anybody thinks anything worse of dads. And I have said many times, I personally was raised by my father after divorce. I am not biased against fathers as parents in any way. The question, though, is whether this bill does what it should do for the entire state and for the entire range of families that it would affect. So I just want to kind of frame it that way. So as we continue to discuss this very important issue, that we not sort of demonize each other about, you know, that anybody doesn't care about families and children. We all do.
Mr. Chairman, may I just make one very quick statement?
Ms. Leppinen.
I feel compelled to say that my colleagues and I that sit on family court benches care deeply about children and families, and I wouldn't be here if I didn't have that deep, powerful feeling that families are important. And while I realize people have had adverse experiences, I'm here to tell you that the judiciary is working very hard to make some corrections in the system. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Lepinen. Representative Johnson, did you have a
question? Just briefly to Representative Cornish as well. You know, it's a very complicated emotional topic, and I think we should just appreciate the testimony we hear from our testifiers and take with it what we can, but you know, everyone has something important to say, and let it go at that, and not, as Representative Liebing said, make it like an adversarial process, which is what we're trying to move away from. We're trying to get some good information here, and let's take it.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Beth Harrington. I'm a licensed psychologist in private practice in Eagan, Minnesota. I work with families involved in the divorce process, or also with never married parents. About half of my practice is doing child custody evaluations, parenting time evaluations, psychological evaluations of parents and children related to family court issues. The other half of my practice involves alternative dispute resolution. I work as a mediator, early neutral evaluator. I also work helping parents draft parenting plans. I also work with parents post-decree who are high, what we call high-conflict parents, who need assistance in resolving parenting disputes. I am opposed to the adoption of House File 322 for the following reasons. Establishing a presumption of joint physical custody does not recognize the unique circumstances of each family. Developing practical and healthy parenting arrangements for children needs to be done on an individual case-by-case basis. There is a huge difference between divorcing parents who have been together 10 to 15 years or longer and have effectively shared parenting of their children, and never married parents of very young children whose relationship was never stable. They never lived together. They broke up during the pregnancy or during the child's infancy, who have little or no experience parenting their child together and have a history of marked conflict. The proposed legislation would treat these families the same. The proposed legislation focuses on fairness to the parents. It does not recognize the importance of the child's needs, which change depending on their developmental stage. Psychological research has clearly established the importance of children establishing a secure attachment with their parent figures. This stage of development extends from birth to at least 3 years of age. Developing a secure attachment requires a stable and predictable day-to-day environment for the child. A joint physical custody presumption elevates the parent's right to shared time over the child's needs. When parents are focused on what's fair for them, they often lose sight of what is healthy for the child. I have seen this played out countless times over disputes over whether a mother should continue breastfeeding a 9-month-old infant because it interferes with the father's parenting time, or whether a 3-year-old should be enrolled in preschool because it cuts into the other parent's parenting time. These are my concerns, that the adoption of this legislation would cause parents to skip over this individual case-by-case basis. As the previous witness testified, the early neutral evaluation process is now being used statewide. I work in Ramsey and Dakota counties as an early neutral evaluator. When parents have the opportunity to sit down and consider the best arrangements for their children, given the children's needs and their life circumstances, such as where they live, their work schedules, they sometimes opt for a shared parenting arrangement with 50-50 time. They sometimes opt for shared parenting that is closer to 35-65 split or a 45-55 split, because that is what best fits the needs of their children. For parents of very young children, they often can develop parenting plans that increase the parenting time for the non-residential parent as the children get older. Parents are able to do this now under the current statute. Though not necessarily sharing time exactly, these are involved parents, involved dads. Dads are not relegated to two weekends a month. These are not fatherless children. In reality, the non-residential parent often sees their children almost daily due to their involvement in their school activities and extracurricular sports and activities. If joint physical custody were mandated, my concern is that these case-by-case discussions would not occur and that this would be to the detriment of the children.
Thank you, Ms. Harrington. All right. Our next testifier will be Linda Allen. Linda Allen in the room? Okay.
She's not here yet, but she could be here before.
All right. Thank you, sir. Michael Detberner. Good morning, sir. Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with testimony.
Yeah, you're not getting Michael Detberner right now.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You're getting Michael Black. Mr. Detberner's up there, but I was told to start. My name is Michael Black. I'm an attorney in St. Paul. I practice primarily in family law area as an attorney and as a mediator. And I come before the committee to oppose the proposed statute. As I read the statute and as I hear the testimony, it appears to me the thrust of the effort is based on a perception that there's an imbalance in the system that needs to be corrected through legislation. I should describe to you my perspective on this matter. I've been practicing law since 1978. I've been a mediator since 1996. I have a one-man law office on the second floor of a building on West 7th Street in St. Paul, pretty middle-class situation. I represent people of both genders in all kinds of situations, all kinds of economic status, including appointed counsel for people who are unable to afford representation, and occasionally people with a lot of assets and income, and most of the time people with modest means who have a difficult process they have to get through. And from where I sit, there is no imbalance in the system. There's a lot of people that believe there is, and perhaps that belief is what generates the concern. But for every dispute which is resolved one way or the other, there's a party who's usually somewhat happy and a party who's disappointed. And there's as many disappointed women over these issues as there are disappointed men. There's as many disappointed people of liberal backgrounds or liberal persuasion as there are those who are conservatives. It doesn't really matter in my perception. There is no tilt one way or the other. In fact, what I've seen in my practice, particularly as a mediator, is that parents are changing their approach to these matters on their own without being prompted by any legislative changes. When I visit for the first time with a parent, I'm often struck by the fact that they seem to appear ready to talk about equal parenting time or fully co-parenting without being prompted by legislation to do so. This is a trend that is supported by the process developed in the family courts over the past few years to get people out of the adversary process and into these early evaluations and to promote mediation. And it's working. And it's working without any legislative changes. In the last week, I had two mediations in my office where parents came in and without prompting really decided to share their children on an equal parenting time basis. It didn't require bending anybody's arm in a painful way. It didn't require re-educating people. This change is happening and it's supported by the courts without being mandated. One of the reasons that it works is because of the standard. in the statute, and the standard is that of what's best for the children. And as I read the sections before you, the best interest standard is being replaced or made subject to this presumption, which is found in the new section to be added to the statute. And I think that the fact that adding what might be perceived as some certainty to the process by creating this presumption will actually alter the landscape for people who are working on these issues with each other. And to some extent, it's the uncertainty about the result because of the focus on the children which leads to these solutions. So if you inject what is perceived to be certainty of result, I think what you're going to get is more litigation and less solutions. Okay. That's my perspective.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Anderson, did you have a question for this witness?
Mr. Chairman and the witness. What county are you referring to? Are you referring to the whole entire state that there's no imbalance in the system, or are you referring to a specific county?
I'm referring to my experience, which involves all the metro counties.
And a follow-up question, Mr. Chairman. What data do you have, court data, to prove your point that there's no imbalance in the system?
I don't come to you as someone with court data. I come to you as someone that's practicing in the trenches, and I'm giving you my perspective from that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Black.
Thank you.
Next on our list is Mr. Brent Rice. Mr. Rice here today? Okay. If you intend to testify, I'd recommend that you please sit down, Mr. Rice, sure. and introduce yourself.
Sure.
For any other testifiers, if you'd make your way toward the front of the room to expedite the process here, I would appreciate that. So. Good morning. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Yep. I'm Brent Rice, and father of five. Now seven, recently remarried 3 years ago, but coming to testify against this particular bill. My experience with the situation is having gone through it in Hennepin County, a divorce situation, what I would say contentious situation. I had good fortune that I met some very talented guardian ad litems, custody evaluators, and enough so that my sense of the situation is as much as I'm a advocate for father's rights, as you might imagine, I think that they did an excellent job and they understand the dynamics with family situations, particularly in a divorce. I like a lot of the language of this particular bill. I think it's eloquently written in a lot of cases. In an intact, involved two-parent home provides optimal environment where children would grow into productive and responsible adult citizens. But I think an intact home is what we had, and now we have something different than that. And often I'm afraid that it's sort of a conflicted situation. And as one of the other testifiers pointed out, people lose sight of what's important for the kids, and they're more concerned about their own well-being. I want to see the kids. It gets to be about them instead of the kids, and that's a sad situation. And I think by putting a blanket statement across the situation and have a presumption of joint physical and legal custodial for the kids may not be the best. And the reason I say that is because in my situation, it was conflicted for sure. There were lots of allegations. I was fearful that, that they wouldn't see that. I was fearful that the guardians and evaluators would not see that, I had spent so much time with the kids. I coached the kids. I was very involved with them. And I was very fearful that they would not see that. But they did it. Like I said, I think they can see through a lot of the actions and the allegations, either side, whether it's the father or the mother. And I think that they do a great job of that. To make it presumptive, I think, is where I would take issue. The other question that I would have with this is, because of the presumption, to turn over the presumption, to overcome the presumption, you know, a lot of these make perfect sense. I mean, you don't want to have a situation where it's domestic violence in the home, or you don't want to have, you know, dangerous conditions. That all makes very good sense. The problem, I think, would come is if one or the other throws out an order for protection, alleging domestic violence, or which was the case in our situation. We probably don't have. This is maybe a small slice of what reality, but it did happen to me, and I can tell you that would have been a near impossibility had we not have a guardian and evaluators looking at the case carefully. So, kind of giving you my own personal experience. I've been at this time in my life. Of course, I've seen any number of divorces. I would suggest to you that most of them would profess to do the right thing for the kids, but I don't see that happening always. So I think you need to have an impartial party come and help.
Thank you for your testimony this
Very
morning.
Very good.
Sorry. All right. Next on our list would be Susan Steen. Not seeing Susan Steen. Paul Frank.
I'm sorry.
Sir?
Asked to come forward at this point. I'm not Susan at all.
All right, sir. Welcome to our committee.
Thanks a lot.
And thank you for helping us expedite this hearing. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Bruce Kennedy, and I've been a divorce lawyer and a mediator and a neutral evaluator for 33 years, and I'm here representing the Family Law Section of the Minnesota State Bar Association. One thing we heard at the previous hearing was that the proponents of this bill have been working single-mindedly on it for more than 10 years, and that another we heard from a former legislature later that this is a part of the evolution of family law. It's not. It's a detour. It's a step backwards. And the evolution of family law has been from an adversarial model more to a problem-solving model. And the key to move in that direction is not to add a legal presumption, but it's early intervention to try to get people at the beginning of the process and persuade them that fighting over their kids and putting them in the middle is not the way to go. Rather, it's to sit down, to work things out, problem solve it, and don't get into a court battle. So when I hear all the testifiers talking about the great amount of litigation and the win-lose, et cetera, I really am at a loss, because what we have now is a system where in all the metro counties and many outstate, when you file your divorce case, within 3 or 4 weeks you're sitting down with a judge at a table talking about how to problem solve the case and not get into litigation mode. And a lot of time people settle their case right then and there, but if they don't, they are referred out to meet with a neutral, a mediator or an evaluator, who will sit down with them again and once again say to them, let's work this out, let's not litigate over this. And maybe they settle it right then. If not, they go on to another such meeting. Very few people actually have a hearing anymore. Now, the proponents of the bill did some research on court statistics. They looked at 7 counties, and their research said that 99% of cases were settled without a trial. 99%. This is their research. They're the ones claiming that litigation is profuse. It's not. 74% of their cases, they said, settled without a judge being involved at all in the case. So we're seeing something very different from what they're seeing. I'm thinking that they were so single-minded about this one provision that they've been working on for years and years that they have failed to notice that things are changing. And fathers are getting custody much more frequently. And parents are choosing joint physical custody much more frequently. and courts are ordering it, even if one of them objects, much more frequently. And evaluators are recommending it. This is all happening without the benefit of any legislation. You don't need to do this. Things are progressing.
Mr. Kennedy?
Yes.
That concludes your comments?
Yes, it does.
Correct. Okay. Anyone else that would like to testify? Oh, excuse me. Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kennedy, is it your suggestion that 99% of cases settle without being seen by a judge? Is it your suggestion that there's no disagreements in these 99% of cases then?
Mr. Kennedy.
The statistic that we received from the proponents of the bill of the counties they studied, 99% settled ultimately without a trial. Okay? There's undoubtedly conflict along the way. All these intermediate processes are intended to slow people down, let them regroup, and problem solve the issues with their parents. They undoubtedly have conflict. And some of them get out of that the cooperative track, and that's inevitable, I'm afraid. But I'm sorry, did I answer your question or not?
Representative Lesch.
Mr. Kennedy, I think you did. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir. Representative Cornish.
Sir, in your testimony there about the number of cases that don't reach court, how many of it's because neither one of the spouses have any money and can't take it to court and therefore never get a court settlement? I mean, I have trouble with this testimony that birds are flying in the air and everything is okay from the other testifier that said the ludicrous statement that there's not an imbalance after we've discussed this in the legislature for years, and then you talk about everything is fine, and I just think back about there's people from NAMI here and Coalition Against Violence and MNCASA, and women and men are being killed and assaulted every year directly from domestic disturbances, and a lot of it because they can't reach a resolution. So for you folks to come down here and pretend that everything is okay, and the reason that they're not in court is because they don't have the money to fight it. We get countless letters from people saying, I can't afford to do this, I just have to let it go. And they go to legal aid, and they don't give much help for divorces. So is it your and the other person's contention that really everything is okay and we don't need any change?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I didn't say that. I said that things are progressing toward an early intervention model where people are encouraged to problem solve rather than litigate. I said that trend is, in effect, it is happening. And I don't know if you can have it both ways, where you're complaining about too much litigation, but then also complaining because people don't have the money to create more litigation.
Mr. Kennedy, Representative Cornish?
I'm not complaining much about anything except the injustice in the system and however we can solve it. I mean, there's definitely an imbalance there, in my opinion, and I think this bill and the other one goes a long way to solve that. We just have a philosophical disagreement. I respect your opinion, and the person was here before, but when I say I completely disagree with you, it doesn't mean I don't respect your opinion. So,
thank you, Representative Cornish. Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman
is up first.
Okay, just an observation. In my opinion, the viewpoint that there is quote unquote not enough money to afford litigation, it does not hold water. Everyone in this country has the constitutional right to represent themselves free of charge and have their case litigated in court.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to respond to Representative Cornish's comment about legal aid. Representative Cornish, it was your budget that cut legal aid last year.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. We have Paul Frank available next. Good morning, sir. Again, I would remind you we're under a bit of a time constraint here, so keep your comments as concise as possible.
All right, thank you. And
please introduce yourself.
I'm Paul Frank from Minnetonka, Minnesota. That's where they say the beautiful people live, and so I'm one of them. You just drive around there and you'll see us. All right, I have kind of an extensive background, and I'm not trying to bore you with it or brag about my life, Right, I think it'll make sense later. I graduated from the University of Minnesota in 1970 with a Bachelor of Science degree in Social Studies, a high school coaching certificate, and I began teaching. While teaching for 30 years, I just recently retired, I also obtained accreditation to teach learning disabled kids, emotional, behavioral, disordered kids. Lots of trouble. Also along the way, I earned my master's degree in educational psychology. During the time that I was studying at the university and after I served as a big brother to four young boys, later I was offered a job as a big brother supervisor. This was prior to the expansion of the Big Brothers, Big Sisters program as it is today. My basic duty with the Big Brothers organization was interview and match worthy men with young boys that didn't have an active father in their life. The goal was for the two to participate in healthy activities. Subsequently, I followed the relationships to see that they were progressing satisfactorily. While taking a leave for education, I joined the police force for 5 years. Add to this over 40 years of officiating sports with amateur, high school, and college teams. In fact, they got as high as refereeing in the WCHA. While participating in all the above-mentioned jobs and activities, I coach sports in the schools and my kids' teams. Wow, I must be getting old. So why do I tell you all this? And why am I testifying you before you today? I'm here because I believe that I know kids very well, and I know the devastation they experience in the manner in which our court system currently operates. Equally important, it is the right thing for me to do. Our kids are grown and gone. I have little, if anything, to gain personally. Listening to the many stories and much of the testimony, it appears to me that the language of the bill and the information presented centers around the need for both parents in their children's lives. That's a given. To me, it feels like there is an elephant in this room, and the words being utilized are carefully stated to be politically correct. In my opinion, the real issue before us that pertains to the proposed legislation is that good, kind, and loving fathers are not allowed to share the time in their children's lives that they previously had, and they still deserve after a divorce. Certainly, mothers are equally important, but unless there are some very unusual, extenuating circumstances, women are not denied the time with their children. Our court system is based on the fact that one is innocent until proven guilty. In most cases, this is not happening with our divorce proceedings. Who suffers as a result of the father being short of time? The kids. I have personally observed this tragedy while working with many boys, girls, and young men in my career. The research is replete with how critical each parent is to a child's well-being and welfare. Please correct this grave injustice.
Mr. Frank.
This may very well happen to you, your children, or your grandchildren. Thank you. Of course,
you,
I'm in support
Frank.
Of this bill. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Frank.
Thank you.
All right. Can I have a show of hands, anyone else that wants to testify in opposition to this bill? Please move to the front of the room, and we're getting near the end of our discussion time on this for today. This bill will be laid over, as for today, this bill will be laid over and be discussed at a future hearing as well. Good morning, sir. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michael Ditbrenner. I'm an attorney from Edina, and I'm the legislative chair for the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. I also work on legislation issues in a similar capacity for the Minnesota chapter of the American Association of Family and Conciliation Courts, an interdisciplinary group of therapists, mediators, and attorneys that work in the family court area. I cut my teeth as a young attorney back in the 1980s, working primarily representing non-custodial fathers in their divorce and custody situations. And back in the 1980s, one of the most controversial issues was this primary caretaker presumption that had been developed by the Minnesota Supreme Court. It applied to cases involving children who were too young to express a preference. And the Supreme Court, in this case called Pakula versus Pakula, had the idea that if we create a presumption that custody should be awarded to the primary caretaker in the case of children too young to express a preference, and that presumption can only be overcome by a finding that that parent was unfit, we'll be able to solve the problem with a lot of litigation. Cases will have more certainty, people will be happier, and we'll be able to go on with our lives. That, unfortunately, did not turn out to be the case. Whenever you have a presumption like that of a certain type of custodian or a certain type of custodial arrangement, of physical custody, that is, it distorts litigation. And when you have to overcome that presumption by demonstrating that the other parent is unfit, you're going to have what I call fault-based custody litigation, an effort basically trying to tear down the other person. And the hope for less litigation did not turn out to be true in the case of the primary caretaker presumption. There was actually an increase in litigation as people rushed into court who never would have previously had a shot of getting primary physical custody but felt emboldened by this primary caretaker presumption. People that just were completely inappropriate custodians. And that's the same problem I see with creating a presumption here, a 50-50 parenting time. Because you overcome the presumption by showing various types of endangerment, which has to be shown by clear and convincing evidence. There's citation to numerous juvenile court statutes, criminal statutes, a domestic abuse statute, a level of chemical dependency that would cause somebody to be committed. And people are going to litigate that. There will be hyper-litigation. And by the way, this statute also overrides our modification statute. In addition to throwing out the best interest standard, people will be able to bring motions for modification of custody arrangements without having to show the very heavy standard proof that we currently have in the law. They'll just be able to show that they're entitled to joint physical custody with equal parenting time. And that'll happen, I guess, under the bill's provisions in July of 2014. So Katie barred the door. A lot of litigation is going to be on its way if this bill is passed. The type of situations with joint physical custody work with equal parenting time, and there's a lot more people doing it these years, is that generally both parents have been heavily involved in the raising of their child. They generally and fairly get along. They don't have any type of mental health issues or chemical dependency issues or personality disorder issues or just a lack of self-awareness that prevent them from reaching agreement and working together. And they live in reasonably close proximity. So you have this presumption. And I'm afraid that you're going to have children being literally split apart. Like the case of Solomon, I think that was testified to the other day. You're going to be splitting the baby. You're going to be shoehorning children into a 50-50 parenting time arrangement, regardless of whether it's appropriate. And the only way that you can overcome that, endangerment. Showing that the child is actually being physically abused or somehow that there's domestic abuse going on. And so, quite to the contrary, this is a full employment bill for lawyers. This will increase litigation, and it will make all the efforts of trying to get away from the litigation phase into trying to encourage settlements. It will basically take that away and break that.
Mr. Ditburner, thank you for your testimony this morning. Okay. We have one more testifier, is that correct? Good morning. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Services Advocacy Project. I did want to note, I just had spoken to Mr. Kennedy in the back. Linda Allen was on the testimony list. She is held up in a court early intervention hearing, actually, and so she is trying to get here. I'm not sure if she'll get here by the end of the hearing.
I would ask you to advise her that she could appear at another committee hearing on this bill.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to talk my comments about the imposing the child protection standard into the family court process and kind of what that means. When you look at the mechanics of this bill, what does it do? What does it mean? It's really necessary to understand as you think about this bill and lifting the concepts of child protection and carrying them over that there are really important differences between a child protection proceeding and a family court proceeding. And I'm going to go through just a couple of those differences. One of the differences is parties. In a child protection proceeding, there's a lot more parties involved, the county agency, the parent, the child, there may be other relatives who intervene, multiple parties involved in those proceedings. The action to remove a child from a home is brought by the state. As a result, the grounds to support removal of a child and potentially terminate that parent's rights are within the context of balancing the parent's right against that of a third party, which is either the state or perhaps another relative. Those competing rights do not have equal weight, and that is why the juvenile chapter has a clear and convincing evidence standard, because it's only at that highest standard of proof that the state's interest should override the fundamental right of a parent. And I know there's been some discussion about fundamental rights before, but that's kind of the big picture dynamic that you're looking at in child protection and why the clear and convincing standard is there. Another big difference is process. Once a child protection proceeding begins under state law, a decision of permanency is made in a year. Within that year, though, the main goal is to try and reunify the child who's been removed from the home with their parent. If that's not possible, they look at different options for permanency, and the parent's rights may be terminated. That's all legal ties to the child are permanently ended between the parent and child. This is very different from family court, which doesn't include a reunification element to it. In family court, the end result may be varying levels of parenting time rather than completely severing the legal relationship between parent and child. In child protection system, termination of parental rights is final. It cannot be modified, as you can modify an order in family court. The third big difference is the level of intervention. During a child protection proceeding, there are really intensive efforts during that year, not only to reunify the parent and child, but to help the parents work with whatever issues brought them into that proceeding in the first place. Okay. The parent has... Yes.
We're at our time limit, so we need to move on. Have you a summary comment? We need to get to a few questions from our committee here.
I will try and wrap it up. I see a question. But
can you wait?
It's important to understand that piece. So there's intensive efforts to reunify parent and child, lots of court hearings then that year. Parents in the child protection system are back in court frequently within that year. So it's a very different process. It's a different purpose and different parties involved. And I think that relates to with a clear and convincing evidence, how when you're carrying that over, you're really kind of looking at apples and oranges, because you're comparing the rights of two parents in family court as opposed to a parent and a third party in child protection.
Thank you, Ms. Hugdahl. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I do have a question, but first the comment that has absolutely no bearing on anything. I'm an attorney and have practiced for 36 years, mostly in family law cases. But Ms. Hugdahl, it's my understanding that of the 50 states in the United States, no state has a 50-50 joint physical presumption. That's correct, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, that's my understanding. There are some states who have taken language saying they want to encourage joint custody.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
that's different from a 50-50 presumption and a clear and convincing evidence burden over.
So the answer is, Mr. Chairman, thank you. So no state has a 50-50 presumption of joint physical custody. All states have some default presumption, and in the case of Minnesota, it's 25%.
Ms. Hugdahl.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, that's correct, and most of them also still have a piece of best interest of the child that's still a very much an active part of
the
conversation.
Thank you. Representative Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is to the testifier. Here's my question. I know that you were outlining the analysis of CHIPS, which is Children in Need of Protection and or Services, and that's when there's a report or a belief that a parent or someone is not living up to their truest form. And I know that in a CHIP proceeding, there's this clear and convincing, evidence standard that has to be adhered to. But I'm also seeing that standard inserted in this context. So would you be so kind as to tell me how does this mechanically work in this bill?
Ms. Hugdahl.
Mr. Chair, Representative Champion, essentially when you take the clear and convincing evidence standard, if parents don't agree and they come before the court, really what's going to happen is that the court has to hear evidence as to whether one of these grounds that would terminate a parent's right in the child protection system is met in the family court. Once you've met that standard, really, the court has seen that you've, you know, committed egregious harm against your child, you've sexually abused your child. It's not like the court is then going to consider reality, I don't think, 30 or 40% parenting time. You're really kind of setting up this all-or-nothing proposition. Either the court's going to have to find it's not met in the order 50-50, or you have met it, and it's pretty going to be pretty close to 100% and zero.
Mr. Chair, Representative Champion, keep it short. We do have another bill to hear yet this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier again. So when you think in terms of the CHIPS proceeding, and there's that clear and convincing evidence standard that is there, and let's say it is proven, there is still a case plan that is put in place, is my understanding, and the statute still drives reunification of that family. Can you tell me if how a family could be reunified if this particular bill is adopted, and if we adopt the clear and convincing standard as articulated in the CHIPS petition?
Ms. Hogg,
statutes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Champion, I think that gets a kind of the apples and oranges way of trying to lift this issue into family court plays out, because once you come to family court and they've met that point, the court's going to be issuing an order. There's no returning to court and check-ins and all of those things. And because we're changing the modification standard to match this as well, that's the order you're going to have probably in perpetuity. So unless you meet a really high standard to try and modify it, that's kind of where things are going to sit. And there is no court check-in like in juvenile court where they would be trying to repair, reunify that relationship and increase over time.
One last follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Champion, you're...
I got you.
10 seconds is all I'm going to give you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the testifiers earlier talked about in this particular bill that there's a difference in treatment, or there's a similar treatment between children born out of wedlock versus children born during a marriage. Is that your understanding, and what is the danger, or what is the impact of looking at both of those scenarios the same way?
Ms. Hogdahl, a very brief answer. We need to move on with our next bill.
A very brief answer. Mr. Chair, Representative Champion, I think that there are such different dynamics when you stop looking at individual factors and apply such a high-level presumption with such a high burden. You're pretty much asking the court to ignore those differences when the parents don't agree.
Okay. Thank you. This concludes our time for testimony on this bill. Miss, are you Linda Allen?
I am.
All right. Can you give us a very, very...
Can I have some time?
If I can give you 1 minute. And
okay. Thank you. My name's Linda Allen. I'm a partner at the law firm of Butler and Allen. We've been practicing in the area of father's rights in family law for in excess of 30 years, and we oppose this bill because it would poorly impact and negatively serve our clients. We have represented thousands of fathers who have sole physical custody of their children or providing primary residence for them. Some examples include a father who was the father of a 2-year-old boy, a mother came in and out of that child's life on and off for 18 months, and my client successfully pursued sole physical custody of him. If that same case had come before the court under this proposed legislation, that poor child would have been in the care of his mother half the time, a parent he didn't know very well, and was leading a nomadic lifestyle. In a second example, I have a case where there's a father of 2 children. His ex-wife was a stay-at-home mom, but as a stay-at-home mom, she watched TV a lot, was disengaged with her children, spent a lot of time on the computer, didn't prepare dinner, didn't do laundry, didn't do schoolwork, got her children to school late. My client has sole physical custody of those children as their father. And if that same case had come before the court under this proposed legislation, those children would have been in the care of their mother half the time with a situation that lacked structure and educational guidance and a nurturing environment. And finally, I have a case where I represented a father where he got custody of his teenage daughter, and his teenage daughter was being demeaned by her new stepfather, and it was negatively impacting her self-esteem, and she started to underperform in school, and he got custody of her. And I would say if that same case came before the court under this proposed legislation, the result would have been different, and that poor child would have been continuing to live with that stepfather, having her self-esteem eroded.
Okay.
And I would urge you to vote against this bill because it's been a disadvantage. All those many, many fathers in the state of Minnesota that are providing the primary residence and care for their children.
Thank you, Ms. Allen. All right. At this time, we will lay House File 322 over for further hearing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have some questions for Representative Scott. Are we going to do that at a later time?
We will do that at a later time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom. Representative Dowd. While Representative Dowd is coming to the table, I would like to welcome the FFA students that have joined us this morning. As a former FFA member, I recognize you and respect you and your leadership skills that you're developing in the FFA, and so welcome to the Capitol. Representative Dowd, first we need to move your bill before the committee. Representative Grunhagen moves House File 2246 for consideration. Representative Dowd, are there any amendments to your bill?
I do not have any amendments, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dowd, your bill is before us. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 2246 is a bill that attempts to correct what we think was a legislative oversight when some changes were made that would allow enhanced sentencing for DWI offenses. So basically the reference to a previous statute we think was misstated and it's caused some legal problems. Some of those have happened in Mille Lacs County. So joining me today is Tara Ferguson Lopez, the Assistant Mille Lacs County Attorney, to tell a little bit more about what she's experienced with this problem.
Good morning. Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Tara Ferguson Lopez and I'm Assistant Mille Lacs County Attorney. I'm appearing in this matter because I've had several issues that have come before me personally in my job as an assistant county attorney that have one of which is up on appeal at this time, State versus Retzloff, and is proceeding further up to the Supreme Court. But we've had to litigate this issue on at least several different occasions on what we believe to be a legislative oversight. Essentially, one of the facts in this case was an individual had been charged with a criminal vehicular operation substance-related offense back in the year 2000. He was convicted of that offense for causing substantial bodily harm to someone else that he had struck in a motor vehicle. He proceeded to pick up in 2009 a new DWI charge, which I charged as a felony level based on the statute and based on what the intent of the statute previously was to allow, once you have a felony criminal vehicular operation conviction, thereafter any DWIs that you commit then would also be felonies. That was challenged in this case, and it's been challenged in several other cases, because in 2006, effective 2007, the statute was renumbered and reorganized and relisted some of the offenses using different numbers, but that didn't carry over to the felony DWI statute that's now in front of you with the corrections that we're adding, essentially just seeking to have the criminal vehicular operation statutes that were numbered prior to the renumbering in 2007 also be included for purposes of using that to enhance future offenses. So I'm here to ask for support with regard to House Bill 2246.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Lopez. Anyone else that will have testimony on this bill? Anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Any questions from committee members? Hearing. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. Is there anybody in opposition to this that you're aware of?
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Liebling, not to my knowledge.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Dowd. Representative Grunhagen renews his motion that House File 2246 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. Any further discussion? All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. Bill is passed. Congratulations, Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. We're done. Okay. I would like to commend the committee for their attendance and attention to the subjects on our agenda today. It's nice to see everyone in the room. And Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is addressed. I came a little bit late, even though I was still here, so thank you for your time.
We have you checked in.
But so I don't know if this was just before I came, but I don't know who the camera guy is, and he was in the way here as people were trying to get in and out. So I'm wondering how you made decisions about people who are given special privileges other than other testifiers. Are we going to continue to have that? Because everyone has the opportunity to come and view the proceedings. People even have the opportunity to view them on camera from their home. But how are decisions made about people who are given special privileges to come inside the ring here and tape people close up?
Mr. Chairman, Representative West, I apologize for interrupting, but I kind of second that motion. I have no problem with people exercising their constitutional right of free speech and so forth, but I think it would be appropriate for this cameraman and any other one who comes in here with a privately owned video camera to identify themselves and at whose request or what group's request they're here for.
Thank you, Representative Smith and Representative Lesh. I will take that under advisement, and we will ask future camera operators recording people that they would check in with the chair before setting up in the committee. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe there's a House policy about media in committees, and so you might want to take a look because certainly placement might really be an issue.
I appreciate the advice, Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Do we know who the cameraman is and at what person's or group's request he's here on? And if you don't, can we ask him because he's in the room right now?
Representative Smith, I think that's an appropriate question. If the gentleman with the camera would like to introduce himself to our committee, we would appreciate knowing who our visitor is today. Welcome to the testifiers table. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey Fuchs. I was hired by Michelle McDonald to videotape the proceedings. I did last time on Tuesday introduce myself to Brian, I think it is, and we talked a little bit, and I just assumed I could do the same thing again today, so I apologize if that's not the case.
Murray. And I would also remind the committee pages that if we do have recording devices in the room, that you would advise the chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Will the individual tell us who the person is that asked you to do this and what group she's with and how your tape will be used?
I have no idea how it's going to be used. I'm just hired as a private videographer. Michelle McDonald, again, with 322. She's for it. And I think she just wants to document how she's going through the court system.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir, for clarifying that for us. And to the members of the committee, I do apologize if we had some misunderstanding, but we will review that policy and make sure that we carry on with it. So with no further business before our committee, we are adjourned.